Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Intellectual Property and Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Groups, was recorded on June 7, 2012, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on Design for Liberty, the new book by Professor Richard Epstein. My name is Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of the Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Richard Epstein is the inaugural Lawrence A. Tisch Professor of Law at NYU Law School. He's a senior lecturer at the University of Chicago Law School, a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, and a recipient of the Bradley Prize. He's a frequent speaker at Federalist Society events throughout the country. We're very happy to have him with us today. He's going to begin with opening remarks about his book, speaking for some 10 to 12 minutes, and then we'll take questions from the audience. With that, Professor Epstein, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Well, Dean, thank you so much for that brief but instructive introduction. What I'm going to do in order to set the stage for what I think to be some of the central themes in this book is to go a little bit beyond what Dean did and to talk not only about the main title of the book, which was courtesy of Michael Aronson, my longtime editor at the Harvard University Press, but also the subtitle, which I changed in one significant way. It now reads Private Property, Public Administration, and the Rule of Law. I thought long and hard before I put that middle piece inside the book, because as a libertarian by inclination and a classical liberal by conviction, I'll talk about the difference in a second, there's always a tendency to try to announce some way in which you could have the system run itself with the least possible government intervention. And it turns out that the more one thinks about the world, the larger the scope of government becomes relative to some hypothetical norm in which you would like all private forms of regulation to be the only forms of regulation that we have to live on. It turns out that you can go back a very long time in history, and you're always going to have an administrative state that deals with such mundane functions as taxation and licenses and the like, organizing public highways and so forth. And the question that one's trying to figure out is what's the optimal balance between the public and the private side, and how that balance interacts with what is commonly called the rule of law. And the basic puzzle that you have is as follows. The rule of law is a decidedly universal virtue in the way in which any kind of affection for private property is not. You can look anywhere you want along the political spectrum, and there will always be fierce devotions to the rule of law, and for very good reason. And the simplest way in which one can find out why it is people care so much about it is they hypothesize, and it all too often observe, the way in which the world works when the rule of law is not observed. So you can think of North Korea, you can think of Syria, you can think of Iran, you can think of Libya, you can think of a wide variety of places in which you do not have adherence to the following kinds of norms, which is that when you're talking about laws, you want them to be of general application so that the inside group cannot discriminate against the outside group in the way in which they impose taxes and other kinds of burdens. You want these rules to be announced and to be noticed in advance so that people have a chance to adjust themselves to what the laws require to avoid both criminal and civil sanctions. You'd like the laws to be administered by impartial officials so that you don't feel you're sitting down at a poker game in which it turns out that everybody at the table turns out to be in cahoots one with another. Essentially, the way to understand a biased legal system is like having to place fair bets when you know that you're starting to deal with a whole variety of loaded dice. So they're all of these kinds of neutral virtues, and the best statement of them were probably found in a book by Lon Fuller called The Morality of Law, in which he was able to put these things forward with a great deal of persuasiveness without committing himself one way or another to any kind of a system. So the intellectual challenge is as follows. If you go back kind of historically and figure out who are the most prominent exponents of the rule of law, people who would be on that kind of list would be John Locke and Friedrich Hayek, I suppose, would be the best exemplars of the earlier and the modern defenders of this particular position. And it turns out that both of them were, in some very large degrees, what we would call classical liberals, meaning that they had a very large space for private property in the way in which they organized their legal regimes, but understanding that there was a need for government coercion and force to raise the taxes and to impose the regulations, which would allow people to engage in voluntary exchange with the assets they had, either in their own labor or in external goods. And so the question that you ask analytically is, given this particular stuff, is the connection that you have between the rule of law on the one hand and private property on the other hand an analytical necessity, such that if you really believe in the rule of law, you cannot deny the existence of private property as the dominant social institution? Or is it an empirical type of arrangement, such that if you understand what the rule of law requires, in the end, a system of private property will better accomplish the ends that the rule of law wants to have, and do so on a fairly systematic and thoroughgoing basis, not only in modern contemporary societies in places like the United States, but in all periods of history and in all corners of the world. And my view about it is, I think my colleague at NYU and sometime critic Jeremy Waldron is correct when he says it's a big mistake to insist that the connection between the rule of law and private property is a necessary or logical connection, because what that does is expropriate a set of neutral virtues and puts it in the service of a single political ideal. But what I hope to do is to explain why it is, if you look at these things from a more practical sense, once you understand how both liberty and property work, you can see why it is that the rule of law turns out to be a highly attractive institution. Now, the way in which you want to begin this particular kind of stuff is more or less as follows. It begins with coming up with a coherent definition of what it is that we mean by the rule, by private property in the first place. And the standard definitions of private property are really quite instructive for the purposes that we have at hand. The first thing to note is that private property is a relationship between one person with respect to a given parcel of land, to take the simplest case, and in relationship to everybody else on the face of the globe. And if you start with that particular kind of understanding, it becomes instantly clear that there is no way in which you can define property rights by a series of voluntary transactions between the owner and every other single person on the face of the globe. The cost of trying to negotiate these deals as people come and go, live and die, and so forth, are so enormous that a voluntary solution to understanding the basic building blocks of our social institutions is simply not in the cards. So what you need to do is to come up with a set of mandatory kinds of requirements and relationships between individuals which can work. What is it that you need to do in order to make this thing up? Well, the first thing you have to do is to make sure that these kinds of rules are going to be relatively simple. And the reason they have to be simple is if they're not simple, they cannot be observed and complied with by the rest of the rule of law, and if they by the rest of the universe. And if they are simple, in effect, then they start to resonate with the requirements of the rule of law that I mentioned before. Secondly, what they have to do is they have to be essentially scalable or expandable. And what this means, in effect, is that if you're going to have a system of property rights and it's going to deal with large numbers of individuals, it has to be a system that's going to work in a society with 1 million people, 100,000 people, or 1 billion people. If, in fact, your property right rules that you're going to have are going to vary with the size and the composition of a population, you're going to have these terrible transitional points which you will not be able to articulate or to understand, and the whole system will essentially clatter. And the third thing that you have to do if you want to have a system of property rights to make it work is it has to be good regardless of the levels of wealth or resources that are found in any particular kind of society. You cannot have a system in which if you're in a poor country, it turns out the property rules are X, Y, and Z. As people get richer, the rules are going to start to change again. It's exactly the same problem that you have with scalability. The moment you start to talk about alternative regimes, you have to be able to identify the transition point, and you have to be able to identify both the previous regime that made sense and the subsequent regime that made sense. So you have all of these particular elements.
And the fourth one that I would add in, which is extremely important, is that any system of property rights, in order to work well, must be able to facilitate voluntary exchanges for mutual advantage between any random two individuals. If you cannot get those voluntary exchanges, it will become impossible to create markets. And once it becomes impossible to create markets, it will be impossible to secure the gains from trade. If you start to look at what the common law rules with respect to land and so forth are, they are, in fact, in perfect conformity with these requirements. What we say, in effect, about a given owner is that the only thing that he can require of other individuals is that they forbear from the use of force or fraud against his particular holdings. The force case is perfectly obvious because what that means, in effect, is that if I have exclusive right to land, you cannot poach on that land, you cannot trespass upon that land, you cannot spew filth upon that land. All of your duties are negative in the sense that you have to forbear. Each of them are particularly well understood so that there are no real complications in their articulation. It is vitally important under these circumstances to say that the rule is confined to these particular activities, because if you say that other people are not allowed to do anything which harms the owner in his holdings, that would lead you to real difficulties in figuring out whether or not competition by A with respect to what he sells on his property against B, whether or not that would count as an improper kind of interference. The moment you allow that in there, the whole system starts to disappear, because it means you cannot preserve consistent like liberties amongst individuals. So the libertarian emphasis upon force becomes perfectly obvious. And so too with respect to fraud. Because if in fact I have land which is attractive and somebody comes along to a potential purchaser or user of the property and lies to him about its essential features, he has not only hurt the individual to whom he has lied, he has also hurt the property owner who no longer can secure that voluntary transaction. So to protect the relational interest, it's not only that you have to prevent them from shooting at your customers, you have to prevent people from deceiving their customers. But if they tell them the truth, at that particular point, the social benefits start to change, because truth in competition is the essential way at which competitive markets start to organize themselves. So a system of private property, in effect, has all these characteristics. And what's most characteristic about this compilation of characteristics is that the degree of government discretion that you need to have in order to run this system is stunningly low relative to that to any other kind of system that you could imagine. You need to have a statute of frauds in order to secure security of transactions. You need to have a recordation system so that people will avoid the risk of double dealing by knowing that if they deal with the person who has record title, they will be protected against any subsequent attack on what they've done. And there are a few other requirements about meets and bounds and measurement, which are of great importance as well. But relative to the modern system of land use regulation, mortgage regulation, and so forth, the rules that I'm talking about are skeletal with a huge difference in complication. So we can now figure out what is wrong with the modern administrative state. It's not that it basically taxes individuals in order to provide benefits, but what it does is it hollows out property in all other institutions to create an intolerable level of discretion on the part of government, which will eventually lead the system to come clattering down. So if you really believe in the classical liberal model, your taxes tend to be flat, the benefits tend to be proportionately distributed to the burdens. The government has discretion as to the level of tax, but it doesn't have discretion as to the tilt of the tax, which means that a lot of the gamesmanship associated with modern taxation, multiple forms of taxation, short periods of taxation, are all eliminated from the way the system goes. And when it comes to regulation, this particular theory says it's the entire bundle of property rights that is protected against government intrusion. And that means not only the right to exclude other individuals, which is the current definition of property rights for constitutional purposes, but also rights to use and dispose of property. And we know that this is essential because when you take rights of use and rights of disposition and put them into public solution, what invariably happens is the government now has the ability to deny a permit to build to one person when it grants it to its competitors and can impose all sorts of exactions as conditions for getting the particular thing done. So if you want to fund a set of public schools, what you tell is somebody who's putting up a building mainly for older people, you have to pay a special assessment to build the school in the neighborhood, which other children or children of other people can start to attend. So there is, in fact, this very close relationship. And what the book does is go through all the variations of the classical liberal theory and the modern theory in an effort to explain systematically why it is in the long run that going back to older theories of property rights with clearer boundary rights, lines on the one hand and stronger forms of restraint on government is vastly superior to the modern system. And the two examples I give, but I will not elaborate on here because it's too long and too painful an exercise, are talking about the many structural defects that are found in the Dodd-Frank law on the one hand and in the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, a PPACA. And the key thing to understand about the poor statute is it neither protects patients nor provides us with affordable care. Both of these statutes essentially suffer from absolutely predictable kinds of mistakes if the basic theory I'm talking about is correct. What you want to do is to limit the level of government discretion, and what both statutes of this sort do, whether they're talking about health care plans that are viable or banks that are supposed to have systematic risk, is to give intolerable level of discretion to public officials who can never bear more than a tiny fraction of the cost when their decisions start to go awry, as so often they do. So on that 14-minute introduction, I'm quite happy to take questions. So thank you all for your patience.
Well, thank you, Professor Epstein. We're now going to open the floor to the audience's questions. Let's go to our first audience member.
Oh, we do have somebody. Great.
Go right ahead, Colin.
John Rowling, Constitution.org. It seems that one approach to this subject that might be explored would be to recognize that perhaps what is attempting to be done is for the society in general and government through it to declare itself to be a partner in the ownership of all property.
Is this supposed to be a good... go ahead.
If that were accepted as a principle, then that lays the basis for taxation and regulation. But then that leaves the problem that whereas the sovereign is recognized as the ultimate owner of real property, and for that, the real property would be the state, that doesn't seem to leave a basis for the federal government to claim to be the ultimate owner or even part owner of real property or a personal property.
Well, I mean, one of the problems to worry about this is when you're talking about the rule of law in a federal system, it's not just a question of trying to restrain the monstrous federal government. You have all the states. And in fact, if you go back to the original Constitution, the only effective federal limit on the state ability to regulate property was found in the Contracts Clause, which proved insufficient to the task, so that when you had the Civil Rights Amendments of or the Reconstruction Amendments of 1868, the most prominent feature was the Privileges and Immunities Clause, which put vast limitations on the way that states could regulate private property without giving additional powers to the federal government, which was, I thought, exactly the right move. But then the next question is, if we do this, the last thing we want, in my judgment, is to treat the government as a partner in any form of asset, real or personal, unless it's done by voluntary consent. This goes way back to Roman law, where the issue was always if you had two people who by mistake mixed their property together, did you make them partners? And the answer is you cannot have fiduciary duties between strangers. It just doesn't work. So the rule that everybody did under these circumstances was to say one person owns the equity in the property and the other person has a lien on the property, and you could always buy out the lien by the payment of a fixed sum of money so as to restore single ownership through voluntary arrangements. And that's the correct arrangement that we want on a government level. You should think of taxes as a lien on property and labor. That is, if you have a tax bill and you decide not to pay this and it's lawfully owing, the government puts a lien on your land. And at that point, it can then take the land if you don't discharge the lien and sell it off to somebody else in private ownership. And throughout every one of these incidences, the thing that you want to do is to avoid creating joint control problems where you do not know how it's going to work out one party to another. So this is not saying that you don't want the government to have a claim over property. Clearly, if it can impose taxation on labor and property, it must have a claim. But you want those to be debt claims. You don't want them to be equity ones. Okay, that's my first answer. Next question, please.
Let's go with the next question.
Hi, it's Dana Berliner from the Institute for Justice.
Oh, Dana, how are
you? Hey, Richard. I'm good. So one of the issues I was wondering about was the relationship, or I guess relative restraint that could be imposed via statute and constitutional reinvigoration. Because although I love the idea of limiting government discretion in a giant administrative state, you're mm-hmm. going to have some of it. And there's only so much, I think, that can be done statutorily. Although, I mean, that's part of my question is how much can we limit discretion statutorily, and what role then does the Constitution play in protecting property
okay,
rights?
Okay, that's a great question. One of the things that I refer to in this paper is an area in which you must necessarily have some degree of discretion, and that's the area of public prosecution of criminal offenses. And it seems clear to me that the mix between management and judicial intervention is very heavily weighted in favor of management controls. That's why I stress the phrase public administration, as opposed to government intervention. So if you want to talk about what the government does wrong when it selects juries or puts people on jury panels or decides to prosecute or not, you can use the judicial system of control to knock out invidious motivation cases, like, for example, people who are excluded from juries because of race or sex or political affiliation. But 99% of the difficulties we have are just running consistent preferences over different kinds of punishment. So you're going to have a situation where three cases come in and you have to decide whether you're going to punish them for manslaughter or for murder and so forth. And what you'd clearly like to have is each individual case being consistent with the others in terms of some general grid of responsibility. And the only way that you can do that is through systematic oversight inside public institutions. So one of the things that I stress in the book and continue to stress right here is that you have to define your criminal offenses narrowly enough so that you can get this kind of rigid behavior. And that's why the traditional offenses on murder and rape and theft, which have relatively crisp definitions in most cases, work a lot better than some of the modern kind of stuff, which start talking about undue impositions in financial markets or something of the sort. If the offense is designed loosely, you cannot administer it correctly. And so therefore, get these things and then appoint public officials who essentially exercise management control internal to the office. And there's an article I cite by a man named Wright and Miller, I think they're their names. And what they do is they compare police departments which do and do not follow these regimes on the level of satisfaction, and you see enormous differences when people are conscious of these kinds of duties. Now, the question is, what about else can you do statutorily and so forth? The first thing, Dana, you got to do is to think of what statutes you want to repeal as opposed to which statutes you want to enforce. And basically, the first rule in all of this business is that any statute which is designed essentially to transfer competitive benefits from one party to another will necessarily create monopoly power on the half of the state, which it could then use to dispose one way or another. So you take something, you know, a particularly bad statute like the National Labor Relations Act, where collective bargaining substitutes in labor markets monopoly structures administered by the government in face of competitive markets, which typically work through at-will contracts. And there is no way that you're going to be able to reform that by changing the rules of elections to card check or shifting the composition of the board between Democrats and Republicans and so forth. The correct statutory response is to basically get rid of any system of public control that disappoints and upsets competitive relationships and to put in its place some kind of monopoly control system, which are breaking down everywhere throughout the economy. Zoning is one sort of illustration. Okay, the next thing that one has to do in this by legislation is to essentially be extremely careful in the way in which public benefits are distributed. They should be given out by competitive forces, not by sweetheart kinds of arrangements. That's true whether you're talking about giving out a parcel of prime property, which is no longer needed for government use, or most importantly, in the case of labor contracts and pensions with respect to government officials. What you need to do is the same thing. You do not have state laws that mandate local governments and local school districts have collective bargaining. What you do is you tell them to go out and to bid separately and competitively and create some kind of an organized market. Now, what does one do constitutionally with respect to this? And on this issue, I'm really as strongly inclined to the positions I took 27 years ago when I wrote my takings book. I'm still inclined to those positions today, which is if you look at a scheme and you see that its primary function is to transfer wealth and influence through government power, as opposed to controlling ordinary common law nuisances, you strike it down and tell the government to get a more targeted approach, which is designed to deal with the issue. What everybody loves to do is to pretend that some kind of a really vicious anti-trade sort of situation is really needed for health reasons. That's how you kept grapes out from Chile, by pretending that they were contaminated. If you look at the TRIPS Treaty, the international treaty dealing with various kinds of intellectual property and stuff like that, they're very clear, since they tend to be free trade agreements. This is under the WTO, the World Health Organization, World Trade Organization, that you have to have a powerful justification for health and security before you keep out foreign goods. And you need to do that as well. This means, and this is something which is perfectly consistent with the IJ mission, which I've shared with you now for over 20 years, is that when you're dealing with government regulation, you never evaluate it under a rational basis test. They did that just last week in some dreadful decision by Justice Breyer with respect to special assessments. And that test essentially allows all the intrigue to start to take place. On the other hand, when you're trying to figure out how you develop a piece of public land for a park, you have to use something like the business judgment rule, because otherwise every outlier will file endless administrative actions in the courts, which will slow things up to the point in which nothing can ever get done. So what we've done is we've got to flip things around. Much more judicial control over legislative regulation and much less judicial control over government management of public assets. I think that would be a fairly strong way in which to go. This is no small change from the current situation. At this point, I don't think there's a single justice on the United States Supreme Court who would buy, at least as a judicial philosophy, into the arguments that I've made.
Okay.
Sounds like a lot of uphill work there, Richard, that we've done.
Well, my life is going uphill. But, you know, if you don't make the intellectual case, you'll never get off the ground. And if you do make the intellectual case, the hope is that you can influence people in political power to take a somewhat different view of their own office. So in the Reagan years, when people like David McIntosh started to think about the question of doing cost-benefit budgeting for various kinds of new legislative initiatives, it was largely on the strength of the kinds of arguments that I and other people at the time had made about the dangers of runaway government. So what you do is you push consistently intellectually for large victories and hope that at least in the short run you can get small victories, either in elections like with the Walker recall that failed, or in the alteration of administrative agencies. And one of the reasons why the Obama presidency has been the shipwreck that it has been is that all these mid-level decisions on levels of enforcement to the executive branches of things like the Fair Labor Standards Act and so forth have always erred on the side of over-enforcement, never on the side of under-enforcement. Next question.
We've got three or four folks lined up here, so with that, let's go to the next question.
This is James Lucas from TimelyRenewed.com.
Yes, James.
I'd like to continue with this issue of implementation. Does not government have an inherent interest in doing the opposite of what you advocate? I mean, the more discretion and power government has through regulation, the more, you know, that adheres to the benefit of government and government officials. So, and I would expand this, if I may, to your recent excellent column in response to Professor Levinson's New York Times article, where you also, you know, point out that the need to kind of return to fundamental principles, which I agree with completely, but I do, again, have a fundamental criticism, which is it relies on politicians to, if you rely on politicians to do it legislatively, it's not in politicians' interest to limit their own powers.
I absolutely do so. Look, and this is not a question of disagreement. I'm trying to put out a normative program. The question of implementation is simply huge. But if you don't make the normative case, you'll never be able to persuade anybody in either a court or a legislature to change their ways and to understand that the sort of steady, persistent decline in American robustness, both on economic and moral dimensions, is a direct consequence of the way in which we do business. And surely enough, if you had Ronald Reagan in the office, when he was there, he at least understood the principles of the founding fathers, understood about some of the dangers of discretion, and in a modest way was able to slow down the rate of expansion of government. Notice I didn't say anything more than that. But you're right. Bill Niskanen, late of the Cato Institute, made his reputation on explaining why it was that public bureaucracies, unchained by legal rules, will try to expand their influence in order to reward, not by way of dollar compensation, because the salaries paid for major public officials are pitiably low, but through the use of power, which is a substitute for the use of payment. It was ironic on this is that the J.P. Morgan Chase was attacked publicly on the grounds that it did not pay its risk officers enough money so that they could attract the best people to oversee the kinds of bets that they have. And I think that's actually a telling criticism against the usual egalitarian criticism, which is why should anybody who happens to manage, you know, $10 billion in assets receive a sum of money more than that of, say, a college professor or a law school professor like myself. But the problem here is, James, quite simply, is there's no way to get outside the system. If you look at the Supreme Court right now, what is clearly is that the conservatives are much more interested in judicial restraint in some form as an abstract entity than they are in massive intervention on the property side. There are occasional signs in which it looks as though they move over. But generally speaking, if you were to take the key barometer on this stuff, which is the role of judicial intervention with respect to confiscatory regulation, arbitrary taxation, and arbitrary land use regulation, the decisions that have come down since 1985 have, on bulk, made things worse than they were before. And you cannot get any of the conservative judges to articulate a comprehensive view. What they tend to do is to go off on individual cases and quirks and facts, but they resist the kinds of generalizations to make this go. And my self-appointed mission is to make sure that they at least hear the drumbeats coming down from the small government crowd. And what we are trying to do is not to advance a particular cause one way or another, but to simply announce that when they see individual litigants coming before them, they have to ask the large transformative question, what's this going to do to overall social welfare if you decide in favor of government discretion? So this recent case coming out of Indianapolis, where it turns out people had two ways in which they can pay their special assessments for future use. You could pay it in a lump sum, or you could pay it over time. Then they changed the assessment system, and they released for future payments those people who decided to do it on a time basis, but they refused to give refunds to people who paid at the beginning. And Justice Breyer, in my opinion, and horrendous opinion, I think, while overstates the administrative complications of cutting a check to give people back the amount of money that would put them in the same position as the people who decided on the other option. Why, when you give people two payment options, you would like huge consequences to turn on innocent types of differences is something that you cannot understand. And this is just one illustration amongst many in which the incentive effects of bad administration and bad politics are wildly underestimated in order to save a few dollars for running a computer program and cutting 10,000 checks, all of which might cost you, you know, $20,000 or whatever the minimal fees turn out to be. So I think there's a huge amount of work to be done everywhere, and what we have to do is to get the public debate back to a point where, in effect, the connections between the rule of law, decent public administration, private property are all there. You can't do it by taking an anarcho-libertarian position of why have government at all. What you have to do is to have a much more classical liberal position in which you're trying to figure out how it is that you control arbitrary uses of discretion, knowing, in effect, that the moment you allow it in one case, you're going to invite it in the next, which is something which I fear the current Supreme Court does not put high enough on its intellectual agenda.
Okay, so I agree with your analysis of the Supreme Court and your goals. And I suggest an additional, not an alternative, but an additional approach. You've said that you think you thought the original understanding of the Constitution was much closer to the normative principles you've advocated. Yeah. Do you think it would be possible to frame a constitutional amendment which would restate and reassert that original understanding?
I am so afraid of a constitutional convention for one reason. Sandy Levinson's going to run that thing, not me. What they did is they took a constitution, which on most of its key provisions were perfectly serviceable, and they managed to mess it up. And the reason they messed it up, whether you're talking about commerce or standing or takings, is because essentially the progressive vision was strong enough that they adapted the Constitution to satisfy the requirements of large government, which means that separation of powers, checks and balances, the decline in the reduction in influence of the administrative state, these things are all regarded as things you don't want to do. You draft it again, the same set of people and the same set of powers will do exactly the same thing. The word conceivable does not appear in the public use clause. It does not appear in the equal protection clause. And yet Justice Breyer and then earlier Justice O'Connor, who is on the Republican side, at least nominally, used that word to explain what the government has to show in order to win. Any conceivable justification. Well, if you could write the word conceivable into a constitution that doesn't contain it, right, then you could write it into any constitutional amendment that I'm going to create. What you have to do is to make them understand that the use of that word is a total abnegation of judicial authority. And to do this, you have this incredible public debate where Kelo, which was a situation in which essentially the Supreme Court laid over and let the state do exactly what they want, is condemned in the popular mind as a form of judicial activism, when it's in fact a form of ultimate judicial passivity. Activism is not a virtue nor a vice. You got to know what the provisions of the Constitution say, and you have to have a good theory as to when government discretion is appropriate and when it is not. And my view is I'd rather argue on the theoretical level than take the risk of a constitutional convention. And on every issue, for example, on Obamacare, when I wrote a brief with Mario Loyola, and you count the number of sort of libertarian types on one side, you come up with a dozen. The moment Charles Fried and Abby Green, that's her name, I'm not sure, Abby Gluck, rather, write a brief on the other side, which I think was completely wrong on every particular, they managed to get within a day 100 people. I know who's going to run this constitutional convention, so I don't want any part of it.
All right, let's go to our next question.
No, let's have it. Talk about fracking. No, never mind. Go ahead.
Go ahead, caller.
Hi, Richard. Scott Keefe calling.
Oh, hi, Scott.
This is great. A broad question, if I could. There are certainly a group of people who either are generally fans of the administrative state because they see the benefits outweighing the costs, or they're kind of operating within the normal constraints of a normal life. They're in it, and so they're doing it. They're just mm-hmm. they've given up to do it. For those two audiences, can you talk about the parts of the book that are still of real use and benefit to them? In other words, what are the messages in the book that tell those audiences useful things that can help them accomplish their agendas? For example, being mindful of whatever benefits there are, but nonetheless, what tips and tricks are there for mitigating or avoiding the costs? So, for example, you point out that there are times when discretion may be appropriate, times when it's not. How would you talk to a current administrator about that stuff?
I think that's a great question. And essentially, I think the easiest way in which to hit this is to talk about the relationship between production and redistribution. And this is the way in which I would do it, is that the first thing that anybody who's in favor of redistribution has to understand, unless you create wealth, you cannot tax it, because there'll be nothing there. And so what you therefore, if you're in favor of a modern state which believes that inequality is something which ought to be redressed, the first thing you have to do is to ask yourself the question as to whether or not any restrictions on the production of wealth through various forms of government regulation are going to help you to achieve that end. So let's just take one which is widely supported. There is a motion by, I think it is, Representative Jesse Jackson Jr. now to raise the minimum wage law on the ground that at $10 it's going to increase the purchasing power of the poor, and so we will jumpstart the economy. What one wants to say about that is it rests on a deep fundamental misapprehension of how markets work. It's not as though the same people who are getting $7.85 today will now just drag down $10. There'll be massive shifts in the way in which the production will take place. So what's going to happen is some people will be lucky enough to climb on higher. Other people will find themselves without work. That means, in effect, that the purchasing power of some of the poor are going to go down in order to offset the purchasing power of the others. It also means that the amount of of taxes you're going to have to raise in order to support the welfare functions are going to further dim production. And so the simple answer in this particular case is, here's a scheme raised by somebody who simply does not know that when you're talking about aggregates in purchasing power, you cannot simply look at the gains by those people who win unless you could also identify those people who have lost, how much they've lost, to see whether these things net out or not. This is not a small mistake. Essentially, the entire, virtue of this current stimulus programs and so forth is the notion that somehow or other, if you tax and put public monies into the things, you'll get a multiplier. And they never ask what's going to happen to the private expenditure, which is necessarily displaced by government decisions. Well, we don't know whether or not the public expenditures get a multiplier of 1.5 and private expenditures get 1.1. If you did, in good times as well as bad, you want everything to be run by the post office instead of by Federal Express. And so once you understand what's going on here, this becomes the position that you take. The first thing you do is you liberalize productive markets at every area. What that does, in effect, is it starts to get more people off the unemployment rolls, more people into the system. Then what you do is you ask yourself, if you had a flat tax, what level of transfer payments could you make consistent with your overall desires? And the answer is, you have a person making $1 million on an 18% flat tax. He's not getting back $180,000 in direct benefits from anybody else. He's probably getting back a quarter of that amount. You've got a lot of money to redistribute right there, even if it turns out that you don't go to progressive taxation. And if you do go to progressive taxation, you have to realize that there are trade-offs again. If you make the taxes too steep, you kill wealth at the top, which is a disaster, because right now, if 20% of the income is earned by the top 1%, 40% of the taxes are paid by those groups. And if you cut their income in half, it's an absolute catastrophe for the federal budget, which is exactly what's happening at this particular point in time. So you keep on telling them, look, there are real means constraints that you have to worry about. It's not just a question of ends. And if you just do kind of local equilibrium theory, identify the guy you like and see why he's better off, and ignore all the trade-offs and all the downsides, you can't do it right. What you discover when you do this is that liberalization of markets costs nothing by way of government services, reduces the cost of regulation, increases the size of the pie, reduces the pressure on the need to need for redistribution. It becomes a dominant strategy. So I've written several things, and I refer to it again in Design for Liberty, called Redistribution Last. Now, what do I mean by that? Oh, callous me. What I mean by is you first liberalize production. Secondly, when you realize that's going to happen, you then rely to some extent on private charitable institutions, whether religious or otherwise, to keep up some of the slack. And then after you've done all that stuff, you look around and you say, where do we need targeted government interventions to deal with certain kinds of problem populations and so forth? And if you did it that way, you would get much more support for the programs you put into place, because they would tend to be directed towards those individuals who have been victims of catastrophic industry through no fault of their own, struck by lightning, hit by a brick, run over by a car, and so forth. And so what you would do is essentially win on both arguments. The idea that somehow or other massive tax transfers can solve the rising problem of inequality is a pipe dream which is repeated by so many famous people that it becomes almost painful to listen to them. Joseph Stiglitz has a new book coming out on the same issue, and he is an economist who should know something about institutional arrangements, and all he talks about when he's interviewed on NPR is his own intuitive sense of fairness, which to my mind is atrophied at birth. So that is, I think, the way in which I would want to approach that issue, is to prove that all programs for redistribution are not equal. You want smart redistribution. You don't want dumb redistribution. You want redistribution late in the cycle of thinking about things rather than to be the first thing on the social agenda.
Okay. I should mention again that Professor Epstein's book, Design for Liberty, is available at Amazon.com and bookstores everywhere. We've still got quite a few questions to get through, so let's go to the next one.
Yeah, Rod Sullivan at Florida Coastal School of Law. I was interested in your saying that an Article 5 constitutional convention was not the vehicle to accomplish these goals. How do, if we want to roll back the administrative state, return the concepts of private property, how do we accomplish that?
When you win political elections, like the one coming up where there's a real difference, you know, whatever one wants to say about Mr. Romney, he's not a carbon copy of Mr. Obama. And then you get decent people who embody this philosophy and appointing judges who are prepared to implement it. And, you know, there's going to be constant pressures on the other side. My view about the basic public in the United States is that the median voter in the United States is now weakly center-right as opposed to weakly center-left. That's already a huge difference in terms of the situation. And that when you start to talk about the current political campaign, what you do is you announce, and this is a short-term strategy, in no uncertain terms, the vehemence of your objections to a whole variety of issues that are being put forward. I mean, we get Jesse Jackson talking about $10 minimum wage laws. You get Harry Reid, an economic illiterate as far as I can see, managing to talk under these circumstances now about an equal pay act so as to eliminate sex discrimination in employment, which is, as markets go, one of the least important problems on the face of the globe. And instead of sitting there saying, well, you know, we realize that American markets are corrupt in this way, but we think this is too much, which is the standard waffle Republican response, what you do is you say, you are stark raving mad to put forward, you'd be more polite than that maybe, forward to put forward these programs which turn out to solve problems that don't exist and create problems that nobody ought in their right mind to have to solve. Unless you take the kind of consistent economic and intellectual line, you're going to lose. That is, I'm going to put it in the following way. I've spent my entire life doing two things. One, trying to make intellectual cases because I think they're right, and then getting out of the way and let political types who may agree with what I do decide which compromises they make in the electoral or judicial process in order to put the program forward. What happens is, I call this the Moses principle or the Aaron principle. You could either be the visionary or you could be the implementer, but there's no one person who can do both roles. So I'm going to sit on the sidelines. I'm not a political type, as most people will know, and push hard on principle. And I would hope that come the election that some of those arguments would be adopted in whole or part by people at the bottom. That is to think of the current election at every level as being essentially the first of the, oh, not the first, but certainly an important election which is designed to question not the liberalism of the 1960s that deals with affirmative action, abortion, and criminal procedure and so forth, but deals with the progressive transformation that took place in the 1930s, first under Hoover. Remember, he was a progressive. He was the guy who was president when Davis Bacon was on the book. He was the guy who was president when marginal taxes went up to 62% of the book. He was the guy who was president when the Norris-LaGuardia Act was put into place. He was the guy who was president when they put in the Smoot-Hawley tariff. And to take after that stuff along with the Roosevelt thing, because the correct line of demarcation is not Republican versus Democrat. It's the classical liberal versus the progressive. And, you know, for the last 10 years, this has become something of a, not a minor, but a major obsession with me. And, you know, if you think of previous speakers, I've worked with Scott Keefe on a large number of intellectual property issues, including trying to stop the so-called America Invents Act, which just makes things stupid without making them better. And I've worked with Dana Berliner trying to deal with all sorts of property rights and Commerce Clause issues before the Supreme Court. That's what one has to do in the short run, and has to do it not by talking about, you know, the various peccadilloes of the president or Mr. Romney, and not about their past records in running this, that, or the other private venture, but by their judicial and legal and political philosophies to see whether or not you can persuade the public that Mr. Obama labors under a set of judicial and intellectual premises that are guaranteed to continue the stagnation and failure that we've had in the last 4 years. This is not to praise everything that the second George Bush did. He made a lot of mistakes as well. It's to push the intellectual issue and hope that if you change the climate of political opinion, you can nudge them both a little bit further towards the small government side of the spectrum. There are very few things that government needs to do which it doesn't do today. The danger is virtually all on the other side, not because we believe that governments did do nothing, but because the major problem we have today, 95-5, is over rather than under regulation.
Okay, well, I just downloaded the Kindle edition, so I'll look forward to reading it.
Oh, thank you so much.
There go your numbers on Amazon.com, Richard.
Well, I guess it's going to float up there. I have to tell you, I mean, first of all, there's no way I could ever get a book review today in the New York Times. So every little bit helps. So thank you profusely.
Let me ask you a question, Professor Epstein. You've mentioned a couple times, I think at least, that no one on the Supreme Court currently would be a fan of doing or would do what you have in mind for them to do. I wonder if you want to identify a past justice who might be in your camp on this, or somebody you'd like to see on the Supreme Court.
Well, the past, I mean, look, I don't want to get myself into future nominees one way or another. Particularly since I have no idea. But, you know, if you're trying to figure out who is relatively consistent on this issue, you see bright spots, but you don't see iron consistency across the board. The greatest Supreme Court justice from this point of view is somebody which most people have never heard of. It's a man named Marlon Pitney, who had been on the equity courts of New Jersey, comes on the Supreme Court in about 1912 and stays there for about 10 years and so forth. He wrote Coppedge v. Kansas, which essentially explained how it was that voluntary transactions consistently entered into would lead to differences in wealth, which in fact were not social problems, and he struck down mandatory collective bargaining at the state level. That's why it was Kansas. He managed to write the best opinion on water law, a case called Kress, which understood that if you knew what the system of private property rights and waters were about, you would not let the government, under the claim of national sovereignty, to upset this system and build senseless giant dams which sort of flooded out innocent people. He managed to get that right. He wrote a famous case called Hitchman Coal, in which he took the right position with respect to yellow door contracts, that is, contracts which say by an employer, so long as you work for me, you agree neither to join nor promise to join a union. That decision became the topic of wrath by Felix Frankfurter and Green, Nathaniel Green, in their famous book called The Labor Injunction in 1930, that led to the Norris LaGuardia Act of 1932. Pitney was right on that kind of issue. He tended to be more or less a relative flat tax guy. He was pretty good on antitrust law. There was a famous case called Duplex and Deering, in which he construed correctly, in my view, the labor exemption under the Section 6 of the Clayton Act in a relatively narrow fashion so that you could not have unions gang up with firms in order to put out of business non-union shops by secondary boycotts and so forth. So Pitney has always been to me the gold standard. There are some pretty good decisions by John Marshall Harlan the first, most namely his decision in Adair, which was the federal version of Coppedge v. Kansas. But our friend Harlan was something of a sucker, in the sense that he always construed too broadly the health and safety justifications that were made available for various kinds of regulations, including many of which was violently anti-competitive. You don't have to color margarine purple in order to make sure that people know that it's not butter. And a lot of these coloring regulations were designed to make the stuff so unappetizing that nobody would turn out to eat it. You know, Peckham probably got the right decision in Lochner, New York, but the guy was actually on many issues a statist. For one thing, it was unforgivable, but he essentially supported Plessy v. Ferguson in Separate but Equal, which I don't think you could defend in any sort of rational constitutional system. He was a big defender of land use regulation and so forth. The guy was not a consistent large statist in what's going on. So there are decisions that you can find that did that. Essentially, if you go through the period until about 1920 and put together small decisions by lots of people, the government had started to expand. But the real damage took place later. First of the great cases that went in the wrong direction was a case called Block v. Hirsch, very bad 5-4 Holmes decision, which sustained rent control on quote-unquote a temporary basis. And the modern version of that is rent stabilization in New York, which is a temporary statute passed and renewed every 3 years without fail on the basis of bogus findings of emergencies, all of which are created by the statute itself. You get Justice Sutherland, who is supposed to be a conservative, and what he does is he manages to give carte blanche to zoning without looking at what it's doing or how the thing turns out to operate. You then get the mortgage moratorium opinions by Justice Robertson, Blaisdell Bank, which create a lot of difficulties, and the famous switches by Charles Evans Hughes, who in 1935 understands what the Commerce Clause is about when he writes the Schechter case, and in 1937 takes the view that the National Labor Relations Act is within the scope of the Commerce Clause. And just to give you a sense of what a revolution that was, in the three lower court decisions at the circuit court level, it was unanimous that the statute was unconstitutional. One of those opinions, I think, was written by Lerner. learned hand. So, I mean, this was just a huge kinds of transformation. And the other thing that we have to do is to praise the Supreme Court in those areas where it does do things well, of which the single most important one is, I think, the Dormant Commerce Clause jurisprudence, which essentially has gone with very sophisticated decisions, including by people you might not think to hear them from, like Justice Stevens, in some of these cases, to create essentially a common market inside the United States when the Congress has refused to act. And so, you know, one of my enduring disagreements with Justices Thomas in particular and Justice Scalia less so is their hostility to the Dormant Commerce Clause. I agree with them that its original constitutional pedigree is very dubious, but the same thing is true with Martin and Hunter's lessee and Marbury and Madison for that matter. But it's been around for a long time. It is one of the great judicial achievements of the United States Supreme Court, and I am very disinclined to wrecking it on the grounds that you can't find an original version of that, because there's nobody who deals with constitutional law who is a conditional, is an unconditional originalist. We all have situations where we're willing to deviate from it on the basis of decisions that have worked very well for the last 200 years. So that's a long version of the answer. Let's go.
I was going to say we've got a couple more questions and a few more minutes, so let's go to the next audience question.
Yes, hello, Professor. Mark Schumann.
Hi,
how are you? So my question is this. Why is it that in virtually no society, there may be exceptions, but virtually no society, does the elite of that society support these ideas? Perhaps there is an exception from somewhere in the 19th century for a brief period of time, although maybe that's arguable. But certainly from before that and to this day, the social and economic elites of societies reject these ideas in favor of statism of one kind or another, or of tribalism of one kind or another. So why do you think, in fact, these arguments are always losers amongst the elites of society?
Well, I don't think they're always losers amongst the elites of society. I think that at this particular point in time, if you were to sort of list the sort of intellectual leaders for every John Maynard Keynes you could find, you could see an equal and opposite Milton Friedman. If you look at the elites that essentially formed our own United States Constitution, they were four square in this corner. The debates between the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists were very severe at the time, but both of them would be regarded as extreme libertarians in the current kind of political debate, and I think they were able to carry out large numbers of people with them. But this is the way in which I would put it. I think there's several reasons. One is that majoritarian politics will tend to favor the median voter. And majoritarian politics then create redistributive systems. And there are many people on the elites who think the following. Hey, if I can get the United States government to give me a patent preference for my drug relative to somebody else's drug, I'm going to be better off, and who cares about these other things, because everybody knows that they're not real social losses, they're just abstractions. And so what you do is you see a constant progression of major corporations going to the United States asking for various kinds of benefits and handouts. I mean, Jeff Immelt, pretty good executive at GE, but when it came to running the government's solar energy program or whichever program it was, there he is arm in arm with Mr. Obama because GE stands to get some very large contracts out of the state. So what happens is if the incentive structure you create allows governments to transfer without just compensation to it all sorts of benefits, opportunities, and tax dollars to the rich and connected, they're going to be in favor of a system which keeps them connected. So, I mean, you know, Zingali from Chicago has written this book about crony capitalism. I don't think that we've gone quite that far in the United States, but I do think it's very instructive to understand that when the levels of political discretion go high, the people who are going to be first online in order to get large handouts are people, in fact, with great means and great connections to government. I'm not objecting to the distribution of income as an income distribution. What I'm objecting to in many cases is that those people who end up at the top of the distribution, not by coincidence, just happen to live in Washington, D.C., and you know, Georgetown is some fancy place, or in the neat counties in in Virginia and Maryland, and the reason they live there is because they're the axis of power. You change the level of political discretion, and you will change the politics of the great elites. At this particular point, it's very comfortable to be very cozy with your favorite government regulator if his name is Charles Schumer, and he can do a lot of things for you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Let's take the next question.
Hello, this Bob Davis in Maine. Richard Pipes, in his Property and Freedom, I think rather conclusively demonstrated that liberty has never existed, nor can it exist without the institution of private property.
He's right.
And, yeah, I believe so. And John Locke wrote once that the end of the law is not to abolish or restrain, but to preserve and enlarge freedom. That is something I think we are missing today, which has not been instilled in the school systems and certainly not within the legal profession. So a predisposition in favor of individual liberty is what is required, no matter how many laws you write or constitutions you write. The desire, the predisposition has got to be there on the part not only of the elite in the society, but in the people themselves generally. And I see no other way of doing that other than through the school system. But unfortunately, I see no way of getting the school system to ever adopt a position where they're going to teach that type of thing. I wonder if you would. I'm trying to get back to something even more fundamental than some of the things.
No, I agree with that. Let me put it out this way. The way in which one has to start with this thing is to recognize that the presumption in favor of liberty can only be overcome by a clear social justification. In my view, there are two kinds of justifications that you can have. One is to the extent that the actions that you wish to take, pollution or aggression, infringes on the like liberties of others, the state should punish you after you've done it and try to prevent you from doing it to begin with by the creation, for example, of a police force, which is the obvious use of a police power. And the second is there are many coordination problems which you can overcome through voluntary action, and there the condition is you may impose force upon individuals if what you give them in exchange, when properly valued, exceeds that which you've taken from them as part of this forced exchange. So those are the two sort of fundamental ways in which the state ought to intervene, and that gets you virtually every form of government intervention you want, from taxation to public roads and so forth. Education becomes key on this particular point, because right now it is not quite a state monopoly, but it's awfully close. And what we tend to do is to populate it with a bunch of people who have the bureaucratic imperatives that were mentioned earlier on in the talk. Strong unions, strong government administrators, they try to snuff out if they possibly can homeschooling or private schools and so forth. And one of the reasons why Milton Friedman was so keen on vouchers was that he thought if you had the government distribute monies, no questions asked, to the individuals who had some degree of need for it, it would reduce centralized control while creating centralized funding. The reason why vouchers turn out to be a much more treacherous operation is that every person who's willing to support them politically will start to attach conditions to the vouchers so that you cannot use a voucher in a school unless it admits all people regardless of race, which may well mean that certain kinds of academies are going to be shut down. Religious institutions don't work very well under a voucher system, particularly if you have somebody like the current president who believes in a very, very narrow definition of what constitutes liberty. So my own preference under these circumstances is to try and shrink the size of the public sector, to be very suspicious of the way in which you put voucher programs in, and to try to get the grounds up movements to handle these sorts of situations by allowing people to opt out of the public school system. And what I would do is to say, look, every real estate tax allocates an amount of money that's going to the education system, and any individual, for his own children or anybody else's children, can take the money out of that system and put it to a private institution so long as they verify that the money is not being used for some other purpose. That would be the way in which I would want to go from this. I would want to do it across the entire system. But yes, I think indoctrination is often inseparable from education, and to the extent that you get monolithic public systems of any political persuasion, these risks become greater. So decentralization in education, like decentralization of authority and power everywhere else, is generally to be preferred to centralized control.
Well, Professor Epstein, we are out of time, but I do
want to... Oh, I'm sorry.
I do want... Well, not to be sorry about. I do want to thank you for making time for us today. And once again, his book, Design for Liberty, is available at bookstores everywhere and online at Amazon.com and other places. I also want to thank our audience for calling in today and for your attention. We are adjourned. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Let's talk about fracking. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.